talking about the arguments for Deutero-Isaiah. And the first was concepts and ideas differ. Hardly a convincing argument. Second argument, difference in language and style. I think that's a more important argument. In Driver's introduction, for example, on pages 238 and 239, he lists a lot of words that occur in 40 to 66, but do not occur in 1 to 39. And then he lists words that occur frequently in 40 to 66, but only rarely in 1 to 39. So you get these long lists of words that either occur not at all in the first part or very infrequently in the first part, and what do occur in the second part. And it's on that kind of analysis that a lot of this argument rests. I think in response, it can be said that it's not too surprising that you would find words in 40 to 66 that don't occur in the earlier part of the book, because the words used depend to a large degree on the subject matter. And if you have different subject matter, it's not so surprising that you're going to have different terminology. So I don't think in itself listing of words that occur in one part and not in the other part is terribly convincing. I think the strongest part of the argument from style is that certain linguistic oddities are pointed out that are said to belong to a usage of later time. Linguistic oddities belonging to a usage of a later time are found in 40 to 66. Now, Driver speaks of that on page 240. To get into that becomes very technical, very involved. I'm not going to do a lot with that. But I will say that even here, the argument is not something that is conclusive. G.C.H. Alders, in his introduction to the Old Testament, this is on your bibliography, not in your citations, but on your bibliography. That's a Dutch work. But Alders says, for example, to take one illustration of this, an argument has been made that difference in style is seen in the strong preference in Deutero-Isaiah for the first person singular pronoun instead of the anopi. So Deutero-Isaiah prefers ani instead of anoti, and that's said to indicate linguistic usage of a later time. Now, the way that works out is in Isaiah 40 to 66, you have ani and you have anoki 21, and it's said that there's heavy use of ani instead of anoki reflects usage of a later time. See, that's the kind of argument. Now, what Alders does is this. He looks at the usage of that elsewhere. For example, in Haggai, you have ani five times and anoki no times. Ani five times, anoki zero times. Now you see, Haggai is post-exilic, so you're in post-exilic time with Haggai. You don't have anoki used at all. Zechariah, ani nine times, anoki no times. Zechariah, ani nine times, anoki zero times. Now you see, Haggai and Zechariah are both post-exilic. If you go to Ezekiel, you have ani 162 times and anoki a few times. He doesn't enumerate it, but a few times. In other words, it does occur. That's in Ezekiel. Now, Ezekiel is not post-exilic, so you're moving back towards earlier time. You're in exilic time with Ezekiel. Now, what Alder says is that it's clear that the tendency not to use anoki in the time of Isaiah 40 to 66 had not progressed as far as the time of Ezekiel, because you've got 21 times here. So it's not progressed as far as in the time of Ezekiel. In other words, it would seem to indicate that these chapters are earlier than Ezekiel. So not in the time of the exile, but sometime prior to the exile, if you look at that kind of a usage. So if you get into things of linguistic oddities, you get into that kind of a discussion. And here with the use of an idiom and oki, it certainly is not something that's conclusive. And then on the other hand, you have studies made which demonstrate points of linguistic agreement between the two sections of the book. So if you get into language and style, you get some unique kinds of linguistic things that you find in both parts of the book that would tend to utilize this kind of analysis for unity rather than for disunity. For example, you're familiar with the expression, thus saith the Lord. And that's Ko Amar Adonai. Ko Amar Adonai, thus saith the Lord. Now, that expression, which is very common in almost all the prophetic books, there is a variant to that expression in Isaiah, where you have Ko with an imperfect instead of a perfect. Yomer. Ko Yomer Adonai. Where the perfect is replaced by an imperfect. And that variant appears only in Isaiah, and it appears in both sections of Isaiah. In other words, it appears in chapter 1, verse 11 and verse 18. It appears in chapter 33, verse 10. It appears in 40, verse 1. In 40:25, 41:21, and 66:9. So you see, it's kind of spread through the book, but it's in the first section of the book. It's in the second section of the book. A variant from a very common expression occurs only in Isaiah. Occurs in both sections of Isaiah.
So we offer Isaiah.
You could argue that, but the point is, you see, to rest any kind of conclusive or construct a conclusive argument out of this kind of thing, no matter which way you want to go with it, is very difficult.
But then you would do research there and be so sloppy and funny and joking.
Yeah.
Be so sloppy and
funny. Yeah.
What was it used to be on me that quote produces later on?
The tendency is that Enochi, the later you go, tends to be used less and less. So when you get to Tosafot time, it's not used at all. In Ezekiel time, it's used a bit. But in Isaiah, it's used, you know, about a third to a fourth of the time.
And then you
find Haggai
and Zechariah as previous.
No, this is Alder's reputation of it. In other words, Alders is saying that just because Ani is used, Anoki is used less, if you analyze the Tosafot and Zohar books, it tends, and yes, it is used less, but it tends to be in pre-exilic time. It would point to that. I think you can prove that from this aspect, but it would point to that. In other words, this is not a strong argument for late post-exilic time. I mean, Deutero-Isaiah is late post-exilic. It's when Cyrus is ready to let Israel return. See, that's the historical setting. And usually the critical scholars say Cyrus is already in the scene, thus his name could be used. And the writer was someone living in the time of the rise of Cyrus.
But Albert is saying that Haggai didn't use it at all.
That's right.
Zechariah didn't use it at all.
Yeah. Few times. Yeah. And but the, this is more than a few times. So what you see on this line, if you're going to say the usage of Anoki moves along this line from more to less, it means you can place Isaiah over here. You don't have to place him up here somewhere. All right. Now, to get back to that book by Rachel Margaliel, when you get to this thing of language and style, her book is really, I think, significant. She presents a very well-argued case for the unity of the book, based largely on agreement in language and style between the two parts. Look at page 26 of your citation. And this is taken from pages 5 and 6 of her book. She says, Krauss enumerates 18 words and expressions peculiar to Isaiah the Second. Several of them, he admits, are to be found, notice this, also in Isaiah the First, but in chapters that Krauss ascribes to Isaiah the Second. So you see, if you list these things unique to Isaiah, Second Isaiah, but then if you find something in the first part, you say, well, that part was from Second Isaiah as well. But, next paragraph. But even if such expressions were to be found in far greater number, what proof can be deduced therefrom? Do special words or expressions or in one or another chapter prove anything? Does that fact give ground for separating this chapter or any other from the body of the book? In the prophets, it is not unusual for one word or more to appear several times in certain chapters, although they are not found even once in any of the preceding chapters. Take the expression Nikmath Adonai, the vengeance of the Lord, which appears several times in Jeremiah 50 and 51, but is not to be found again in the whole book. Is that sufficient reason for separating these two chapters from the book? Or again, the expression Halalei Kered, slain by the sword, is found no fewer than 10 times in Ezekiel 31 and 32, but does not appear even once in the preceding chapters. Does Ezekiel 31 start a second Ezekiel? In every prophetic book, it is possible to point to numerous words, phrases, expressions appearing several times in only one chapter or in a group of chapters, and not elsewhere in the book. We are left to conclude, then, that such words or phrases are favored in terms of the context, the specific message of the prophecy given in the particular chapter. Now, that's, I think, only logical. As regards the arguments that the two sections of the book of Isaiah differ in language and style, which according to Ben Zeev is a thing that cannot be proven by example, we shall demonstrate in this book by hundreds of examples that the opposite is true. Not only are the two sections similar, both in language and style, but they are remarkable for their unity, in that the similarities between them cannot be ascribed to any influence whatever. Then what she does in her book is this. Notice the next statement. The system here employed, and this is taken from page 42 of her book, the system here employed to demonstrate the unity of both parts is briefly as follows. After classifying the entire book of Isaiah by subject, we have shown that in regard to each subject, both parts employ innumerable like expressions, which are peculiar only to this book. It has also been proved that the specific expressions reveal the same vigor in both parts as well as the same usage. Some even common expressions are distinguished by a particular use identical in both. The second section inverts the words of the first. Passages and word groups of the first are composed of elements found only in the second, and vice versa. Now, I've not included further comment from in your citations from her book on this, but you see what she does is classify the entire book of Isaiah by subject. And here's some of her subjects. designations of God, designations of the people of Israel, formulas of prophecy, messages of consolation, things of that sort. And she has, in fact, uh, 15 subject headings. And the way she works that out is this. Say the first one, designations of God. She lists divine titles used exclusively in Isaiah. So they're divine titles unique to Isaiah that are common in both parts. So with designations of God, divine titles used exclusively in Isaiah, common to both parts. Designations of the people of Israel. 11 epithets referring to the Jewish people alike in both parts. Formulas of prophecy. 20 introductory formulas, opening or stressing prophecies in the earlier chapters with their linguistic parallels in the later sections. So she, see, she goes through the book like that and just piles evidence on evidence on evidence of similarity of linguistic usage in unique kinds of ways that occur in both parts of the book. And I think she makes a powerful case by doing that for unity of the book. See, words of admonition, 21 different wordings of rebuke peculiar to Isaiah, common to both parts. Now, we get back to the argument. You see, the argument is there's a difference in language and style. Margalioth turns that around and says there is a similarity of language and style on the basis of this careful analysis. Now, it seems to me that with this kind of argumentation, no matter which way you're going, that complete proof of authenticity can no more be provided by this method than can the reverse be done. That is, authenticity be disproved. I don't think this type of argument is conclusive either way. I mean, you could say with Margalioth finding these unique expressions in both parts of the book that you could, you know, theoretically you could say, well, do throw Isaiah, just to grant the construction for a moment. Deutero-Isaiah was so familiar with the first part of the book that he adapted the expressions in his own writing and utilized them in the second. So they could say that. So I don't think that Margalioth can prove without any question unity of the book by this kind of a method. But I don't think the reverse is true. You can't prove that there are two different authors because you find some evidences of difference in language and style. What constitutes such a difference in language and style that would force you to the conclusion that you must have two different writers? I'm sure if you took your own writing from 15 years ago and compared it with something you were writing today, you'd find some differences. And yet you wrote it. So, see, from this kind of a line of argument, I don't think that you can prove conclusively either the unity of the book or the disunity. I think what Margalioth has done, though, is in answer to the kind of arguments that the critics have shown, is that you can equally well produce a very solid argument for unity of the book as you can for difference between the two sections. So the book is complex, and the language is complex, and the usages are complex. Look at page 27 of your citations. There's another thing that we're probably going to hear more and more about, and that is the use of computer linguistic assessment of biblical material as that relates to the question of authorship. In Oswalt's book on Isaiah, his commentary in chapters 1 to 39, he alludes to that in connection with this issue of Deutero-Isaiah. Notice what he says. The nearest thing to objective proof of a lack of unity in the composition appears in Y. Raddai's impressive investigation, the unity of Isaiah in the light of statistical linguistics. Radai did a computerized study of numerous linguistic features of the book of Isaiah and compared these in the various sections of the book. As a control, he studied other pieces of literature, both biblical and extra-biblical, which were reputed to have come from one author. As a result of these researches, he concluded that the linguistic variations were so severe that one author could not have produced the whole book of Isaiah. As might be expected, these conclusions were greeted with approbation by critical scholars who saw their positions being vindicated. But in fact, Radai's conclusions call into question some scholarly views. A number of questions may be raised concerning Radai's methodology. The very infancy of the field of statistical linguistics raises some questions. Do we yet know enough to speak with confidence about the possible limits of variation in a given person's usage? Footnote 5 there. I think that's a very real question. Notice footnote 5 down below. Note that another sort of computerized study of the book's characteristics led to the conclusion that it's a unitary composition. L.L. Adams and A.C. Rincher, The Popular Critical View of the Isaiah Problem in the Light of Statistical Style Analysis, Computer Studies, 1973. Here you have two studies come out with opposite conclusions. While yet another, A. Kasher, The Book of Isaiah Characterizations of the Authors by Morphological Data Processing in the French Journal, concluded that the composition is not a unity, but his results pointed to different divisions of the book than did Radai's. For a review of the difficulties inherent in the statistical approach, see Posner, The Use and Abuse of Stylistic Statistics. Now, I don't know where that field of study is going to go. I think it's just beginning. It's probably undoubtedly going to be pursued. But I think what Oswald says is certainly something at this point that is appropriate. Do we know enough to speak with confidence about the possible limits of variation of a particular person's usage? I don't think so. And the studies at this point are conflicting. Although Radai has come out with his analysis that many people have grabbed onto, saying, you know, that computer analysis, so all you have to do is say that, and then, you know, to many people, that settles the case. The computer knows. But what kind of things do you feed into the computer? And how do you make those judgments? Get back to after note 5 there. None of this is to question the integrity with which Radai's study was undertaken and performed, but it is to point out that the evidence is still not as objective as a manuscript in which only chapters 1 to 39 or some such would appear. No manuscript evidence for two Isaiahs. In fact, you have the Dead Sea Scroll material that is a single book, and that's an early manuscript. Notice footnote 6. It is ironic that those who lauded the reliability of Radai's methodologies as applied to Isaiah were much less convinced of its reliability when he recently reported that the same methodology established the unity of the book of Genesis. Okay, let's go on to the argument from historical background. That argument from language and style, it seems to me, is not a conclusive argument again. But I think you have to look at it both ways. The very nature of the argumentation means that it's very difficult to construct a conclusive argument on that kind of a basis. Argument derived from historical background. I think that probably this is the most important argument. Not that it's the one that is convincing necessarily, but I think of the three arguments, it's undoubtedly the most important argument. It's undeniable that Isaiah 40 to 52 has a very different historical background than the early part of the book. As we've noticed so far, in the early part of the book, there's a lot of rebuke, announcement of coming judgment, prediction of the exile because of Israel's sin. You get to Isaiah 40 and following, you don't have that kind of material. There's no prediction given. In fact, the situation is that the people are already in exile. And the emphasis now is on the promise that God will deliver from the captivity. So instead of announcement of judgment, here is consolation and hope and promise of God's intervention on their behalf. In the first part of the book, there are many references to the Assyrians as the great enemy. But you get to the latter part of the book, it's not the Assyrians who are in view, but the Babylonians and the rise of Cyrus, the Persians. The people are in bondage to the Babylonians, but soon to be rescued by the hand of God through the instrument of Cyrus. So, very different historical background for the first and the second parts of the book. Now, given that, that can be explained only in two ways. The way the critics suggest is that the latter part of the book is written by a different author who lived after the exile had begun and was in progress, and the historical background is the background of that writer who lived at a much later time than Isaiah. That's one way to explain the difference. The other way is to say that Isaiah wrote it, but in his doing that, he was led by the Spirit of God to bring these words of comfort and hope to his people after they would have gone into exile. That the exile would not be forever, but that God would intervene and deliver. Now, those are the only two ways you can explain it. If you take the latter view, the view that Isaiah is the writer, you can still ask the question, and this is a question that's often asked, would there be any purpose in Isaiah writing something that would have reference that was not going to happen to them, or that was going to happen in the rather distant future? Question. Look at page 28 of your citations under Wybrae's little study guide, the second paragraph there under Wybrae. This comes from page 4 of his second Isaiah booklet. He says it is clearly addressed to a group of people who have been exiled from their homeland by a conquering power, which is also is referred to by name, Babylon. In four passages, 43:14, 47, 48:14, 20, Babylon is spoken of by name in these terms. And this historical situation is confirmed in numerous other passages. Chapters 40 to 55, then, would have made, notice what he says, no sense in the 8th century when the people of Jerusalem and Judah were still living at home under the rule of their own kings. When Babylon, far from being a great power, was and remained until the fall of Assyria in the late 7th century BC, long after the death of Isaiah, merely one of the cities of the Assyrian Empire. And when Cyrus had not yet been born, and the Persian Empire did not yet exist. On the other hand, everything in these chapters makes good sense as the message of a 6th century prophet to the Jewish exiles in Babylon. So, see, the question is raised, what about the relevance of Isaiah 40 to 66 for Isaiah's own contemporaries? Does it have any relevance for them? Look what Freeman says to that question, page 25 of your citations. This is from Freeman's Introduction to the Old Testament Prophets. He says, not every prophecy needs to be traced to a definite contemporary historical situation, nor directly applicable to the generation to whom it is spoken. It cannot be maintained, as Driver contends, that, quote, the prophet speaks always in the first instance to his own contemporary. The message which he brings is intimately related with the circumstances of his time. His promises and predictions correspond to the needs which are then felt. Obvious contradictions to this concept of prophecy are Zechariah 9-14, speaking of things way beyond the time of Zechariah's contemporary, Daniel 11-12, same. Isaiah 24-27, same as Isaiah's apocalypse, he's talking about the end time. In addition to those already mentioned, this is not to overlook, of course, a general relationship of prophecy to the historical situation which called forth the prophetic utterance. I think what Freeman is saying is, it's quite clear that not all prophecy has direct and immediate application to the contemporaries the prophet spoke, and I think that's a good granted. But when you get to Isaiah 40 to 66, even though Freeman, I think, is correct in pointing that out, I think you still can say that Isaiah 40 to 66 does serve a purpose in relation to people of Isaiah's own day. In the early part of the book, Isaiah seemed to have two objectives. And that was to declare to the nation its sin and its duty to repent. He does that repeatedly. To declare to the nation their sin and their duty to repent. And then secondly, to tell Judah that God was going to punish them for their sin by sending them into exile. And that was quite clear. There were those who listened to Isaiah and responded to his message, although they were the exception. For the most part, the people turned away from what he said. They didn't want to hear it. The prediction of Isaiah 6 was being fulfilled. Remember in that vision of the call, the Lord said in Isaiah 6, 9 and following, "Go tell his people, hear indeed, but understand not, see indeed, but perceive not. Make their ears heavy, shut their eyes, lest they see." And so the people were not going to respond to his message. And for the most part, they didn't. That was being fulfilled, but it was also clear that the exile predicted in 6, 11, and 12 was inevitable. See, 11 and 12 of chapter 6 says, "Then I said, Lord, how long? He said, until the cities be wasted without inhabitants, the houses without man, the land be utterly desolate. The Lord had removed men far away." He was speaking of the exile there already in chapter 6. Yes.
So you're saying the significance of chapter 46 is that Isaiah's contemporary is confirmed that there would be an exile?
Yeah, I haven't quite developed that, but I think it confirmed that. But then it also gave those people hope that the exile was not going to be forever. There was going to be deliverance, and this was not a judgment that was going to end the nation and the people. God was going to intervene and come back. And I think that would have been a comfort to the godly remnant, the people who did listen to Isaiah. Because, you see, if you trace this, I see I'm up against the clock here. Maybe I ought to hold off with this, and we'll pretty much stop at this point. But you see what happened, what I want to trace is subsequent to Hezekiah, you get into the reign of Manasseh, where things get worse, and where you look at Kings, it becomes very clear that the exile is inevitable. And I think this second part of Isaiah was probably written during that dark period of time of Manasseh. So let's pick up at that point, beginning of the next hour, and conclude our discussion of this third line of argumentation, difference in historical background.